disservice to all. I helped with the only annual manager evaluation in 5 years. I'll keep using my organizing skills to help WBAI get back on mission. Please rank me 1. Justice and Unity is endorsed by Bernard White and Larry Hamm. Go to justiceunity.org.
For more information on the election, visit elections.pacifica.org.
Hello, this is Kiani Brea, WBAI's local election supervisor for 2016. Bright yellow envelopes containing ballots for the local station board delegate election were sent out on August 15th. If you are a member of WBAI and have not received a ballot in the mail, please send an email to les-wbai2016@pacifica.org or call 646-535-4059. Please be sure to include the spelling of your name and your mailing address and phone number. You are eligible to vote in the 2016 election if you contributed a minimum of $25 or volunteered at least 3 hours between July 1st, 2015 and June 30th, 2016. Members, please support your station by participating in this democratic process. Get involved. Vote.
What's up, family? This is Felipe Luciano, and I'll be kicking down the doors and bringing the fire every Friday from 6 to 8 a.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Did you know that over half of all black Americans have Native American blood? Did you know that Islam had a profound effect on Puerto Rico? Or that there's increasing evidence that Latinos make up 10 of the lost tribes of Israel? Miles and Puente, Palmieri and Coltrane, Batan and Jackie McLean. Music you need to get you going for the weekend. Fridays, 6 to 8 a.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM with Felipe Luciano. Beloved, we don't bring the funk. We are the funk. Fridays, 6 to 8 on WBAI.
Hi everyone, this is Marisol from Con Sabor Latino Montuneando con Marisol, inviting you to our fall fundraiser happening on Sunday, October 2nd at the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater in Manhattan. I Like It Like That is a new musical starring Tito Nieves and backed by a live salsa orchestra. It's written by David Maldonado and it's from the producers of Quien Mató a Hector Lavoe, Celia and La Barbería. For tickets, call 212-581-9859 Tuesday through Friday from the hours of 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. and ask for Magali. Again, that's 212-581-9859. And please say the code Con Sabor Latino, I Like It Like That. Get your tickets ASAP and support WBAI and Con Sabor Latino. See you there.
This is DJ Hard-Hitting Harry, producer and co-host of Haitian All-Stars Radio, heard right here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Tune in for a special day and time on Saturday, October 8th, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. as we broadcast live for the WBAI October Fun Drive. Join us as we raise funds, as well as play great music that Team Haitian All-Stars is known for. We look forward to your valued and continued support of WBAI on behalf of our radio show, Haitian All-Stars. To make a contribution, call 516-620-3602 or visit give2wbai.org. Don't miss Haitian All-Stars Radio in a special day and time, Saturday, October 8th, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. right here on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM, your community station.
My name is Kofi, and I'm an intern at WBAI. To help ensure that the station will continue to inform, entertain, and educate the listeners in a unique and critical view on politics, art, music, literature, health, and culture, please support our upcoming fall fun drive. What makes WBAI unique from most radio stations is that most of all funding for the station is from you, the listeners. So you can definitely have an impact on the well-being of the station beyond being a loyal listener. Just by donating $25, you could become a member of WBAI and be eligible to vote on the local station board. The fund drive begins on Monday, October 3rd, and the phone number to call in is 516-620-3602. Or give to, that's the number to, WBAI.org.
My And you're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I am Catherine, and this is Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And I am joined by my cohorts here in the studio.
Paulette Spencer.
And?
Matt Mazza.
Okay, I think I got everyone's mic. I'll turn them all on just in case. Yes, and so here we are back with you again this Wednesday, Thursday morning. And what can I say? We're going to be in Fun Drive next week. So let's really rip it up tonight. Let's have some fun.
Okay.
Not that we don't have fun, with the fundraising deal, but, you know, this is nice. And there's actually a phone. Now, if I had, like, bells and whistles, I would ring them right now. There is actually a call-in line. And I say that, a call-in line, but we're happy to have it. It is 347-335-0818. So hopefully throughout this morning we'll take a call or two. We could take as many as we like, but only one at a time. But that's lovely. That's lovely. So I'm really happy of that. Matt, I can't see you.
Oh, okay.
Move along to the other side of the table. There you go. There you go. So, so it's a fun morning. The weather is getting a little bit cool, which is actually quite nice.
Very nice.
Very nice out tonight, yes.
Yeah.
It's really fall.
Yeah.
Great sleeping weather.
Yeah, it's good weather, and for those who like a little bit of a chill in the air, I like it in the fall. You know, after this brutal summer, it feels glorious. But give it another month, and I'm going to be saying, oh, it's cold, it's cold. I won't complain, but I'll be remarking, wow, it's cold, because that's how it is. So here we are, and we finished our series in the Bronx doing the work in the park. So, Paulette, tell us a little bit about that program, what it was all about, since it was something we were doing together.
So the aim was to bring out the community residents to get them even more used to doing like physical exercise in the park. And we tried to make it as interesting and as fun as possible. Mm-hmm. We, of course, used were privy to your wonderful gift as a meditation instructor. Mm-hmm. With exercise. We did a lot of work with a chef who provided nutrition workshops and food tastings. Mm-hmm. And we also worked with a fitness trainer who did a little bit more rigorous exercise for people who wanted to move a bit quickly. And so we were very successful. We, you know, had a few bumps along the way, but we figured out how to make certain things happen, and, you know, it's all part of the learning process. So
yeah,
it's going to move forward.
And the organization is Bronx
Community Health Network.
Bronx Community Health Network just goes to show you what happens to a brain after midnight. And then, this is really all about bringing community service. And, you know, this is the reason why I wanted to do it. This is the reason why I wanted to talk about it, because it really is important, I believe, to expand beyond the domain of commercial work and to really get into community work. I think it's important. And so I'm happy that I was able to be a part of that. But we're done for the summer, at least for the outside part of it. But it was a nice experience. We went to a series of parks in the Bronx and would do our meditation movement routines. And then Chef Wilson came, and it was always interesting to see what snacks she would bring. It was actually a meal. It was more than a snack.
Yeah.
I mean, one day it was burritos, another day it was gazpacho, different things. And then Nanamdi Nelson was the one who was doing the fitness training, which is really not like going to a gym fitness training.
Yeah.
It was gentle fitness.
Yes.
Training. So hopefully we'll be able to look forward to that again next summer. and people will be able to come out and enjoy that experience. It was truly very, very cool.
I'm hoping to bring dance to the streets also. So I want to, I'm in the process of planning for Latin dance, Caribbean dance, African dance in the streets.
Didn't they do that at Lincoln Center?
They do. They do that all throughout Manhattan, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure that this is something that the community sort of comes out for. So if you're going to have, you know, an evening of salsa dancing, you know, you come out and you get a lesson, mm-hmm. and then you can spend the rest of the night just enjoying the music and dancing with your partner. I want to do something similar for African music, as well as Caribbean music, mm-hmm. so that, you know, this is not necessarily in a park, doesn't have to be, but in an open space, mm-hmm. where people can look forward to it. So I'm hoping to make that happen.
For the next series.
Yes.
That sounds great. Well, it's lovely to be able to engage in that way, you know, on a community basis, and to have that kind of work is pretty special, I think, to be able to do that. So that's really cool. And it's interesting, as we were talking about the show, we were like, what do we want to talk about? And I thought that it might be really interesting to talk about that idea. What if there was an end to war and there were no more conflicts in the world? Would people be able to stop fighting? Because the reason I say that is because I think one of the important things to think about is, at what level of conflict do we engage in our personal lives? Very often we hear about the wars, we have compassion for wars, and people suffering all over the world, but I wonder how much we actually do in our own life to bring peace into the realm within which we have some control, with which we can have an impact. So I think that that's an important consideration for us all to have, to think about whether or not we are engaging with each other peacefully or violently. And it really can come down to conversation. You can say something to someone that can be cruel and hurtful, or you can say something to someone that can be neutral, or you can say something in a way that makes it uplifting. So we have a lot of choices that we can engage in that will begin to create a peaceful coexistence on the ground. And I think that if more people are doing that, then pockets of peace can expand from the ground up. And we wouldn't find necessarily that vulnerability to media programming that's going to be feeding all of the fear and hate into our minds. Because when I look at the campaigns and I look at the people that they choose to put on the television and put into the media, it's so inflammatory.
Well, look at that debate the other night. Wow.
I didn't watch it.
Neither.
Was it inflammatory?
I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
they were going at it pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't find that these debates add anything to the mix. It's just another opportunity for sound bites and negativity and trying to tear the other guy down. And, you know, all these people have records. You know, you could look and see what they did. You know, there's nothing that Trump or Hillary is going to say in a 2-hour debate, however long it is, that's going to erase their record. So to me, it's just an opportunity to be fed more toxic energy, toxic conversation, toxic dialogue.
I
don't need to watch it. I mean, I might want to read what they said later, but...
Yeah, I find it a little bit depressing, but I would have watched it if Jill Stein had been included.
There you go.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, what was very interesting was that Amy Goodman had a program where she had Jill Stein, and they asked her the questions that would have been asked of her if she were actually at the debate. We only do that at WBAI. Nobody else did that.
Yeah.
That I know of.
Well, probably some internet shows do it, but no other networks for sure.
The fact that they excluded her is just very telling.
Well, I think that that's part of why so many people are turning away, because the corruption of the parties, the Democratic Republican Party, is so evident at this point. You know, the way that they sort of undermine the campaign of Bernie Sanders. Why he's supporting that, I don't know, that whole system. To me, it just shows how much he really is a part of the system.
Hmm.
Because otherwise, I don't think he would have capitulated so easily if he wasn't firmly entrenched in the system. Now, I'm not saying that he wouldn't have been the best choice, but obviously he values that system and wants to sustain it. So it's interesting. It makes me wonder. You know, I remember when he was running and I had made a comment about him being in the Bronx. Well, he's only there because he's campaigning, which I felt was a fair statement. Not to take away from all the wonderful things that he does and says, but when you're campaigning, you end up going into areas you wouldn't normally go into. And so, but this whole scenario does remind me a bit of the Obama campaign, when he came out, you know, with this glorious hope, you know, idea, and people wanted to, were so hopeful, they were. And then he got into office and it was like a dud, really, in terms of what was able to be done. And then the second time around, it wasn't really any better. And he actually enacted a lot of problematic things that really changed the global situation for the worse. So, you know, I just don't have any faith in this system at all.
Well,
so.
It brings to mind Naomi Klein. She is the author of Shock Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually just another CD that we have. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I'm getting used to it.
But in the beginning, she says, President Obama, come on. Who was his largest campaign contributor? Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's what happens. That's, you know, and you can hate on the candidates if you want to, but the system, it's the system that corrupts the whole game plan. So if it wasn't a system in which all this money was being poured into it, then there would be a more equal playing field, and people who have some ethic could rise to the top. There would be potential for that. So we have a fixed system, and it's designed to protect and to defend the money masters, I guess I would say, the people who profit from the system. So I'm feeling a little bit of a dropout syndrome in my own mind. So I don't watch the debates, because to me there's nothing new there.
Well, this is what the Greg Palast movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I mean, he shows you who's doing what. It's very, very gross, very graphic. I mean, he shows you who's doing what. And, you know, a lot of these people, you don't hear about them a lot. Yes, we hear about the Koch brothers, but
There's probably more people behind the scenes. And we have, it's actually a benefit for WBAI, and there's one more night, right?
That's what I understand, yes.
So I'm going to play that card for people since you brought it up. And if anybody wants to catch this Greg Palast movie, you should do that.
Donald Trump says the election's rigged. He should know his buddies are rigging it. This is Rolling Stone investigative reporter Greg Palast. I go on the hunt for the big fix that could steal this election, and I hunt down the billionaires behind the scam. It's the New York premiere of my new film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a tale of billionaires and ballot bandits. Join me, Randy Credico, and celebs this Sunday at 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. screenings of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy at Cinopolis, 23rd Street and 8th Avenue. Get your tickets at WBAI.org. That's The Best Democracy Money Can Buy this weekend, based on my bestseller, now a true-life detective movie featuring Rosario Dawson, Ice-T, Richard Belzer, and Willie Nelson. All proceeds to WBAI go to WBAI.org. This is Greg Palast. Join me there.
All right, so this was actually running for the weekend that passed.
And it's extended till Thursday.
So it's extended till Thursday. So because of it's extended, well, tomorrow would be the last day. So I suggest you go to WBAI.org and check it out if you want to go see that film. I think it, just for the PSA, I would go. It was so funny. I was thinking, I don't want to see that, but it's, I like that guy. He reminds me of Dick Tracy.
Right.
Greg Palast is very funny. So there it is. But, you know, so what I have felt is that the impact that we have on the political scene is very minute, at least at this stage of the game, until it all comes crashing down, which I believe it will at some point, because there's no money there to prop it up. All the money's been put offshore, the actual money, and the government actually has no money to run itself with. It's in people's accounts.
You know,
everything is debt. You know, they just keep printing money.
But there's a part of it all that I think makes me realize that we're still in the majority, and look at how much effort is being made to sway our opinions and keep it focused. I mean, if we were powerless, they wouldn't spend all of that effort and money on this machine to create this alternate reality.
I have a different perspective on it. I think that it's about making money. You know, a lot of money goes into it, but a lot of money is made from it. And so the people, I don't think, have any real power in it, because the elections don't even matter. You know, the Bernie Sanders campaign shows us that you can vote for somebody and they can still shred your ballot. You know, so I'm not really thinking. And then the people are manipulated to be at the top so that they can put all the deals in place, all the treaties, all the background deals in which people make more and more and more and more money. The people are just, we're just debt slaves and pawns. I don't see, especially Americans, maybe in other countries, I don't see the power. I'm not saying that I am personally disempowered, but I don't see how the system empowers people, because the elections are not real.
I'm not so much saying that the system, what I'm trying to say is that I look at how much effort is being made to manipulate us. And if we absolutely didn't matter whatsoever, they wouldn't. I know there's money involved, I get that. But in terms of aiming it or targeting us in terms of swaying opinions and what have you, why would they even bother if they were not thinking that, you know, if let's say the voting could sway one way or the other by some, I don't know, some twist of fate, and they don't get what they want? Why would they put so much effort into all,
you know,
of this, other than the money, which I get?
I don't really know, but it reminds me of when I first became aware of conspiracies, grand conspiracies. I was a child when I was told that there was no Santa Claus.
Oh.
after I found out there was no Santa Claus, I was through with media. I was through with adults. I'm like, wait a minute. You need to tell me that you have put all this together, you know, all of this hype, all of this stuff, you know, you celebrating in church, you're associating it with Jesus, and you're talking about there's no Santa Claus?
Yeah.
But I was listening to the radio, because when I was little, they used to have this thing where, you know, they would say, well, Santa Claus is over Iowa. They'd be covering the, you know, the movement of the sled. And I was a little kid, so I was into it. And then you didn't mean to tell me that it's all a lie. I felt that I could never trust again.
Wow.
So I was a child conspiracy theorist. I was like, oh, there's a conspiracy at work here. So for me, I liken politics to that. I don't really know the motivation, but I know that it's a big fix.
Well, you know, it brings to mind, there's a very good thing you can Google. George Carlin, The Illusion of Choice.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. He does a whole thing. It's amazing.
Does he curse in it?
Oh yeah, he uses a lot.
Yeah, I was going to look it up and play it, but if he's cursing, I can't do it.
No, it's not cursing. It's his very own seven dirty words. Seven words.
But that's why we lost our license and went to court. Those seven dirty words. I don't think I want to play that.
Right. We wouldn't play it, but I mean, listeners can Google it at home.
Yeah.
The privacy of their own homes.
No, because I was just going to do it, but that's why I asked the question. So I won't be doing that. But yeah, so to me, it is a big fix. And I also look at it from the spiritual level. I look at it from a vast spiritual level. Why don't you run and get some water? I think it has a lot more involvement. I think that there's an advantage to keeping people motivated by fear and moving according to making choices based on fear, because as long as people are pushed into fear, then it becomes easy to see their neighbor as their enemy because they're so fearful of everything. It's easier to see a person of a different culture or color as your enemy. And so then that fear that which there's been, you know, frothed up in the populace is what gives license to the kind of actions that take place on the national and international level. It's based on the fear that people have and the loathing that people have for each other. So as long as you can, you know, beat that into a lather, then that's more the purpose, as far as I can see, as opposed to believing that our votes actually count. The votes would count if the candidates weren't already bought and if the system were even, like Matt said, if all the candidates could be part of the debate, then it would be a worthwhile debate. But if they can't, then it's not a real debate. It's a sideshow from my perspective.
No, I agree, and I mean, the comment about Santa Claus is hilarious, because I picture Santa Claus going shopping in, like, July, wrapping the gifts and putting them in the closet, and you're standing there, like, in December saying, well, those boxes have been there for months now. Oh, you mean there's no Santa Claus? But that's just me. But yeah. My point is that I tend to think about industries that one make money off of, you know, churning or trying to engineer reality for you, and then I start to ask, why are they doing that?
Yeah, well, I think for me, it's obviously the system of money and debt. Mm. You know, because people go into debt every year for Christmas.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like this whole, it's like all of the advertising machine of getting people to go into debt and spend their money. And then, you know, as people become more and more impoverished by this system, they become more and more angry and looking for somebody to be angry at. And so the whole system is geared to turn us in on each other, rather than to look at the real problem and see what the real problem is. So I think that's all part of this system. And the only real solution, as far as I can see, is for us to begin to wake up to what's happening and step out of it and really see what's happening so that we don't become fuel for it, so that we're not at each other's throats, so that we're not fearful and hateful of each other. And we begin to remember that we're all part of humanity and you know, no, it's not all Muslims of the world who are to be feared. You know, if you understand that a lot of these extremist groups are funded by these very same people that are funding our presidential elections, then you can maybe put two and two together and say, wait a minute, there's something going on here, and there's a grand manipulative plan. And what's happening is that people are just being run through a meat grinder, you know, country by country by country, since the Reagan administration, certainly till now, if I just look at that swath of time. you could see the devastation of countries and cultures and archaeological sites and just death and destruction around the world. For what?
Politics.
And money. Politics, money, power. And I think there's a component of energy in it as well. Because everything is energy, from my perspective. Money is energy. Fear is energy. Love is energy. And people feed on all this, and they accumulate this wealth and power. And, you know, they're just, you know, it's like Pinky and the Brain. They're just really crazy, and they can't get enough. And here in the United States, you know, we are, by not being awake to it, we're succumbing to more and more restrictions on our civil liberties, on our rights. You know, we're basically, Americans are not free people. We're not free people. We have the illusion of freedom, but we're not actually sovereign free beings in the system. So from my perspective, the only answer is to pull consciousness out of that, to really recognize the sovereignty that we do have as human beings, as a divine right, as an inalienable right. And, you know, kind of go back to the beginning, and we need to kick this whole system to the curb. That's my opinion. I don't know how to do it exactly, but that's my perspective.
Okay.
Anyway, we have a lot of readings tonight. Matt's going to do a reading, but I also have an article I want to share. Also, the number here is 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. If you want to rant on the political scene, now would be the time to do it, because we're going to shift gears and go spiritual on you. So now's the time to do it. And that number is 347-335-0818. Okay. Well, don't say I didn't try. So I have an article I wrote, and it's called Buddha, Christ, Krishna Within. I tell you, it's going spiritual. Okay, so to start with, Buddha, Christ, Krishna waits inside you. This is not about religion. It is about the presence within, so look within. It matters not to whom one connects for inspiration or that any historical figure play a role in one's life. At the time of their incarnation on Earth, these beings came to anchor an energy on the planet. Those named in the title are not the only ones. There have been avatars, both male and female, who played this role in each culture on Earth, and we each individually hold the same potential. Our purpose here is to affirm and resurrect this truth of our collective inner reality. Do we have a call?
You had one.
Next time. You call back, I'll let you in. Let's see. In the past epoch, it was customary to codify the lessons of our spiritual teachers into rules and practices that would help us to guide our way. In our current time of awakening, these practices can still form a foundation according to one's cultural affinity. But we are now being called to embody and activate our divine wisdom within and as our individual expression. Okay, so we got a call coming in. I'm going to break through my spiritual thingy. Hello, you're on the air?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Please turn off your radio.
Okay.
And then you can speak because we are live.
Please, just one moment. Mm-hmm.
This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Yes.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
You are live. Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yes, I can.
Okay.
Ms. Sherman, I'm from Queens. I'm a member of WBAI, and you had like a really great discussion tonight. I'm sorry to break in. It took me a little while to get to the telephone.
That's okay.
I was getting happy ready to
have
leave.
You.
And I just wanted to just say, you know, I was glad how you answered back about the about our freedoms. That's so true. Is that we're not really free. I can wake up in the morning and I can decide what I want to put on, what I'm going to have for breakfast. But the real freedoms, they're not mine. You know, it's just a big sham. I didn't watch the debate. Like you said, they didn't have the other candidates there. So, you know, they're just throwing the same thing back and forth, you know, and it's this, the way the system works, it's important that the populace remain docile and divided. Like you said, there's people that put money on both sides, mm-hmm. like Smith and Wesson. They don't care. They'll give guns to everybody because they still make money. Money is power. Money is energy. Like you said, it's important that the way that the system works is that the population be docile and be goaded on with a carrot in front of them. You know, like spend money, go in debt for Christmas. And whatever. And incidentally, like the lady said, it was hilarious what you said about Santa Claus, because it's true. Everything is so commercialized. You know, like I remember when I was younger, I'm 64, born in 52. I'm from Queens, mm-hmm. and not too far from, I think, from where you're from, on the island. So what happened is that I remember that, like, after Thanksgiving, then you started to see Christmas stuff, just like, you know, like the Halloween stuff, wait until it wasn't until October. But now, start to see Christmas stuff in the store already. It's just all about money. It's about, you know, buying these gifts, going in debt. And it's ridiculous to want. It's like a buy, buy, buy. And that's what they want. You want you know, this car is no longer any good. You know, buy something else. Or they build in obsolescence. You know? And so it's like a merry-go-round. You know, and it's sad. And it's like, hopefully things will get better because the system is just not working for us, you know? And I'm not feeling so good because I heard about the gentleman that got killed in San Diego, you know, and black people are being shot down. I'm a black man, and black people are being shot down. And no matter who it is and whatnot, you know, this, you know, it's just sad and whatnot that to have to be under the gun like that. I'm going home tonight. Maybe something will happen. I'm going from Brooklyn to Queens. Maybe something will happen to me, you know. Yeah. And you know, it could just happen, you know, and it's not a good feeling, you know. And, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. You know, I just can't deal with this. I just don't understand how these people are so attached to the Democrats. It's the same game. You know, they're both for it, you know, and it's not going to be any change, you know. So I'm not afraid of being the president because maybe some people will get galvanized, you know, and start to really do what they need to do. I don't want him to be the president. He's like, he's a madman. Yeah. He just says anything that comes to his head. And it's ridiculous that these people, the population is dumbed down, you know? And
it's all about that control. And the truth of it is, I believe, that a lot of what's happening with the shootings and the violence, all that is to keep people embroiled in this fear and keep the focus on that. Because if black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, white people, if we all take a step back and really look at the system, we're going to recognize that we are better served by being allies to each other than playing this game. And so we
That's
have to
true.
Keep being
I distracted. Love everybody. You know, I want peace and justice, you know. And, you know, I'm so sad and I'm so glad that WBAI is on the and I support you. And I look forward to meeting all of you at some future date.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for
Thank you for
taking my call. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye now. Oh, it's so nice to get a phone call. It's been a while. It's like ambrosia. Okay, so I'm going to go back to my readings. Okay. There have been avatars, both male and female. So keep an eye on the lights. If somebody comes, I'll distract myself from my reading. There have been avatars, both male and female, who played this role in each culture on Earth. We each individually hold the same potential. Our purpose here is to affirm and resurrect this truth of our collective inner reality. In the past epoch, it was customary to codify the lessons of our spiritual teachers into rules and practices that would help us to guide our way. In our current time of awakening, these practices can still form a foundation according to one's cultural affinity, but we are now being called to embody and activate our divine wisdom within and as our individual expressions. This expression is not dictated from on high, but crafted and woven through our personalities as urges, desires, and actions. Soul guidance often comes to and through us in these ways. Our work is to recognize when we are in and when we are out of soul alignment. The unity within our human collective will blossom as we each individually come into alignment with the Buddha, Christ, Krishna within. Each person will forge a path according to their own guidance and life plan. There is also a collective life plan, and this we are a tapestry. Our unity arises by honoring and respecting each thread, the fullness of its color and texture. And as each thread weaves its unique path, the design and beauty of the tapestry emerges naturally and harmoniously. In this cultivation, patience, tolerance, and forgiveness are principles that function as tools to bring forth grace and understanding. These tools are beneficial to the work of reorganizing our thought processes to realign our minds to the new way of our beings. When these principles of grace are offered to oneself and to one another in kindness and with gentle interplay, we forge a peaceful countenance and coexistence. This way of interacting can allow opportunities for personal and collective discovery in concordance with the emergence of divinity. As wisdom flows through us and is expressed through our words and actions, we begin to transform our reality. In this transformation, it is also important to accept our emotions, whatever they may be. Anger, resentment, fear, and sadness are powerful emotional signals that allow us to recognize that there is something in our energetic field that is calling for our attention. But how do we cultivate this process? We can look within before acting and or reacting. Both impulse and inspiration often serve a twofold cause, one being a response or resolution to an exterior situation, the other being a realization of inner sensitivity that has been evoked by an experience or exchange. When we regard the exterior situation as an opportunity for inward reflection, we can slow time and move into alignment before choosing the best course. We can practice patience, and when we practice patience, we can take all the time we need to find clarity. With that clarity, we can afford a compassionate response to any given situation. Patience, gentleness, tolerance, and compassion are expressions of grace, expressions of divine love that lead to greater understanding and growth. When honoring of each other in this way, we have an opportunity to be the vehicle through which grace is offered to another. One can always call for grace or invoke that you're doing something for the good of all, but there is a refined state of mastery that can be cultivated through living and embodying these principled energies. So the article then goes into a meditation, which I'm not going to read. But if you want to find the article and the meditation, you can go to GaiaScenicsView.com. GaiaScenicsView. GaiaScenicsView.com. We'll play a little music, and then we'll be back in just a moment.
Summer soft wakes you up with a kiss to start the morning off. In the midst of herself playing Santa Claus, she brings gifts through her grace. Morning rain gently plays her rhythms on your window pane, giving you no clue.
to bring rain or sunshine. And so you wait to see what she'll do. Is it sun or rain for you? But it breaks your heart in two. Forcing danger's way with his breeze. Morning's now plans to have a winter ball for you to throw. But just well when he never lets you know. If it's snow or clear days, you'll find. And so you.
Started with Michelle Indiocello and Earth, and this was, of course, Stevie Wonder's Summer Soft. Summer Soft? It's a nice song. And now we're going to have a reading from Matt. So, Matt, remind us what you're reading from.
Okay, we're reading from Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, a novel, an adventure of the mind and spirit. And to recap, for those of you who haven't, who are just tuning in and haven't heard the earlier readings, a young man answers an ad. The first time I read the ad, I choked and cursed and spat and threw the paper to the floor. Since even this didn't seem to be quite enough, I snatched it up, marched into the kitchen, and shoved it into the trash. While I was there, I made myself a little breakfast and gave myself some time to cool down. I ate and thought about something else entirely. That's right. Then I dug the paper out of the trash and turned back to the personal section, just to see if the damn thing was still there, just the way I remembered it. It was. Teacher seeks pupil, must have an earnest desire to save the world. Apply in person. And so he goes on. Stupid, childish, naive, simple, callow, or just fundamentally dumb. And one so manifestly normal in another respect, it needs explaining. During the children's revolt of the 60s and 70s, I was just old enough to understand what these kids had in mind. They meant to turn the world upside down, and just young enough to believe they might actually succeed. It's true. Every morning when I opened my eyes, I expected to see that new era had begun, that the sky was brighter blue and the grass a brighter green. I expected to hear laughter in the air and to see people dancing in the streets, and not just kids, everyone. So he finds out that this didn't quite happen as yet. So he had a little bit of cynicism. He became a little bit jaded. And then he goes on, he finally answers the ad. And it turns out his teacher, this teacher, turns out to be a gorilla. And they proceed to have this dialogue on an intellectual level about various and sundry topics. And so we come to chapter 6 here. Section 1. And how are you feeling today? Ishmael asked. Palms sweating? Heart going pit-a-pat? I gazed at him thoughtfully through the glass that separated us. This twinkle-eyed playfulness was something new, and I wasn't sure I liked it. I was tempted to remind him that he was a gorilla, for God's sake. But I held it in and muttered, relatively calm so far. Good. I like the second murderer. You are one whom the vile blows and buffets of the world have so incensed that you are reckless what you do to spite the world. Absolutely. Let's begin. We confront a wall at the boundary of thought in your culture. Yesterday, I called it a monument, but I suppose there's nothing to prevent a wall from being a monument as well. In any case, this wall is an axiom stating that certain knowledge about how people should live is unobtainable. I reject this axiom and climb over the wall. We don't need prophets to tell us how to live. We can find out for ourselves by consulting what's actually there. There was nothing to say to that, so I just shrugged. You're skeptical, of course. According to the takers, all sorts of useful information can be found in the universe, but none of it pertains to how people should live. By studying the universe, you learn how to fly, split atoms and messages to the stars at the speed of light, and so on, but there's no way of studying the universe to acquire the most basic and needful knowledge of all the knowledge of how you ought to live. That's right. A century ago, the would-be aeronauts of the world were in exactly the same condition with regard to learning how to fly. Do you see why? No, I don't see what aeronauts have to do with it. It was far from certain that the knowledge these would-be aeronauts were looking for existed at all. Some said it wasn't out there to be found, so there was no point in looking for it. Do you see the similarity now? Yes, I suppose. There's more to the similarity than that, however. At that point in time, there wasn't a single piece of knowledge about flying that could be considered certain. Everyone had his own theory. One would say the only way to achieve flight is to imitate the bird. You've got to have a pair of flapping wings. Another would say one pair isn't enough. You've got to have two. And another would say, nonsense. Paper airplanes fly without flapping wings. You need a pair of rigid wings and a power plant to push you through the air. And so on. They could argue their pet notions to their heart's content because there wasn't a single thing that was certain. All they could do was proceed by trial and error. What would have enabled them to proceed in a more efficient way? Well, as you say, obviously, some knowledge. But what knowledge in particular? Lord, they needed to know how to produce lift. They needed to know that air flowing over an airfoil. What is it you're trying to describe? I'm trying to describe what happens when air flows over an airfoil. You mean what always happens when air flows over an airfoil? That's right. What's that called? A statement that describes what always happens when certain conditions are met. A law. Of course. The early aeronauts had to proceed by trial and error because they didn't know the laws of aerodynamics. Didn't even know there were laws. Okay, I see what you're getting at now. The people of your culture are in the same condition when it comes to learning how they ought to live. They have to proceed by trial and error because they don't know the relevant laws and don't even know that there are laws. And I agree with them, I said. You're certain that no laws can be discovered concerning how people ought to live. That's right. Obviously, there are made-up laws, like the laws against drug use, but these can be changed by a vote. You can't change the laws of aerodynamics by a vote, and there are no laws like that about how people should live. I understand. That's what Mother Culture teaches, and in this case, you agree with her. That's fine. But at last, you have a clear understanding of what I am attempting to show you, a law that you will agree is not subject to change by any vote. Okay, my mind is open, but I can't imagine any way in the world you're going to accomplish that. What's the law of gravity? Ishmael asked, once again, startling me with an apparent change of subject. The law of gravity? Well, the law of gravity is every particle in the universe is attracted to every other particle, and this attraction varies with the distance between them. And that expression of the law we read where? What do you mean? It was derived by looking at what? Well, at matter, I suppose. The behavior of matter. It wasn't derived by a closer study of the habits of bees? No. If you want to understand the habit of bees, you study bees. You don't study mountain building. That's right. And if you had the strange notion that there might be a set of laws about how to live, where would you look for it? I don't know. Would you look for it? Would you look into the heavens? No. Would you look into the realm of subatomic particles? No. Would you study the properties of wood? No. Take a wild guess. Anthropology? Anthropology is a field of study like physics. Did Newton discover the law of gravity by reading a book on physics? Is that where the law was written? No. Where was it written? In matter, in the universe of matter. So again, if there is a law pertaining to life, where will we find it written? I suppose in human behavior. I have amazing news for you. Man is not alone on this planet. He is part of a community upon which he depends absolutely. Have you ever had any suspicions to that effect? It was the first time I'd seen him raise a single eyebrow. You don't have to be sarcastic, I told him. What's the name of this community of which man is only one member? The community of life. Bravo! Does it seem at all plausible to you that the law we're looking for could be written in this community? I don't know. What does Mother Culture say? I closed my eyes and listened for a while. Mother Culture says that if there was such a law, it wouldn't apply to us. Why not? Because we're so far above the rest of that community. I see. And can you think of any other laws from which you are attempting because you're human? You are exempt because you're human? What do you mean? I mean that cows and cockroaches are subject to the law of gravity. Are you exempt? No. Are you exempt from the laws of aerodynamics? No. Genetics? No. Thermodynamics? No. Can you think of any laws at all from which humans are exempt? Not offhand. Let me know if you do. That will be real news. Okay. But meanwhile, if there does happen to be a law that governs behavior in the community of life in general, humans would be exempt from it. Well, that's what Mother Culture says. And what do you say? I don't know. I don't see how a law for turtles and butterflies could be of much relevance to us. I assume that turtles and butterflies follow the law you're talking about. That's right, they do. As to relevance, the laws of aerodynamics weren't always relevant to you, were they? No. Well, when did they become relevant? Well, when we wanted to fly. When you want to fly, the laws governing flight become relevant. Yes, that's right. And when you're on the brink of extinction and want to live for a while longer, the laws governing life might conceivably become relevant. Yes, I suppose they might. Section 3. What's the effect of the law of gravity? What's gravity good for? I say that gravity is what organizes things in the macro, on the macroscopic level. It's what keeps things together. The solar system, the galaxy, the universe. Ishmael nodded. And the law we're looking for is the law that keeps the living community together. It organizes things on the biological level, just the way the law of gravity organizes things on the macroscopic level. Okay. I guess Ishmael could sense I had something else on my mind, because he waited for me to go on. It's hard to believe our own biologists aren't aware of this law. Lines of amused astonishment crinkled the blue-gray skin of his face. Do you imagine that Mother Nature doesn't talk to your biologists? No. Then what does she tell them? That if there is such a law, it doesn't apply to us. Of course. But that law doesn't really answer your question. Your biologists would certainly not be astounded to hear that behavior in the natural community follows certain patterns. You have to remember that when Newton articulated the law of gravity, no one was astonished. It's not a superhuman achievement to notice that unsupported objects fall toward the center of the Earth. Everyone past the age of 2 knows that. Newton's achievement was not in discovering the phenomenon of gravity, it was in formulating the phenomenon of a law. Yes, I see what you mean. In the same way, nothing you discover here about life in the community of life is going to astound anyone. Certainly not naturalists or biologists or animal behaviorists. My achievement, if I succeed, will simply be in formulating it as a law. Okay, got it. Section 4. Would you say that the law of gravity is about flight? I thought about that for a while and said, it isn't about flight, but it's certainly relevant to flight, inasmuch as it applies to aircraft in the same way it applies to rocks. It makes no distinction between aircraft and rocks. Yes, that's well said. The law we're looking for here is much like that which, with respect to civilization. It's not about civilization, but it applies to civilization in the same way that it applies to flocks of birds and herds of deer. It makes no distinction between human civilization and beehives. It applies to all species without distinction. This is one reason why the law has remained undiscovered in your culture. According to Taker mythology, man is, by definition, a biological exception. Out of all the millions of species, only one is an end product. The world wasn't made to produce frogs or katydids or sharks or grasshoppers. It was made to produce man. Man, therefore, stands alone, unique, and infinitely apart from all the rest. True. Section 5. Ishmael spent the next few minutes staring at a point about 20 inches in front of his nose, and I began to wonder if he'd forgotten I was there. Then he shook his head and came to. For the first time in our acquaintance, he delivered something like a mini-lecture. The gods have played three dirty tricks on the takers, he began. In the first place, they didn't put the world where the takers thought it belonged, in the center of the universe. They really hated hearing this, but they got used to it. Even if man's home was stuck off in the boondocks, they could still believe he was the central figure in the drama of creation. The second of the gods' tricks was worse. Since man was the climax of creation, the creation for whom all the rest was made, they should have the decency to produce in him a manner suited to his dignity and importance. In a separate, special act of creation. Instead, they arranged for him to evolve from the common slime, just like ticks and liver flukes. The takers really hated hearing this, but they began to adjust to it. Even if man evolved from the common slime, it's still his divinely appointed destiny to rule the world and perhaps even the universe itself. But the last of the gods' tricks was the worst of all. Though the takers don't know it yet, the gods did not exempt man from the law that governs the lives of grubs and ticks and shrimps and rabbits and mollusks and deer and lions and jellyfish. They did not exempt him from this law any more than they exempted him from the law of gravity. And this is going to be the bitterest blow of all to the takers. To the gods, other dirty tricks, they could adjust. To this one, no adjustment was possible. He sat there for a while, a hillside of fur and flesh, I guess letting the pronouncement sink in. Then he went on. Every law has effects, or it wouldn't be discoverable as a law. The effects of the law we're looking for are very simple. Species that live in compliance with the law live forever, environmental conditions permitting. This will, I hope, be taken as good news for mankind in general. Because if mankind lives in compliance with this law, then it too will live forever, or for as long as conditions permit. But of course, this isn't the law's only effect. These species that do not live in compliance with the law become extinct. In the scale of biological time, they become extinct very rapidly, and this is going to be very bad news for the people of your culture, the worst they've ever had. I hope, I said, that you don't think any of this is showing me where to look for the law. Ishmael thought for a moment, then took a branch from the pile on his right, held it up, for the law, and held it up for me to see, then let it fall to the floor. That's exactly the effect Newton was trying to explain. He waved a hand toward the world outside. That's the effect I'm trying to explain. Looking out there, you see a world full of species that, environmental conditions permitting, are going to go on living indefinitely. Yes, that's what I assume, but why does it need explaining? Ishmael reflected another branch from his pile, held it up, and let it fall on the floor. Why does that need explaining? Okay, so you're saying this phenomenon is not the result of nothing, it's the result of a law. A law is in operation. Exactly. A law is in operation, and my task is to show you how it operates. At this point, the easiest way to show you how it operates is by analogy with laws you already know, the law of gravity and the law of aerodynamics. Okay, end of subsection 5.
All right, the law of gravity. Very interesting. Well, I think that's where humanity did get into a little bit of trouble, by thinking that we are not subject to the laws of reality, the law of life, the law of creation. You know, the same, well, that's how we managed to destroy half of our planet, or whatever percentage of it so far has been destroyed, I suppose.
And it also shows, you know, if you want to apply this to the political scene, these people that are wealthy consider themselves above the law. You know, if you pollute the river where indigenous people live and they get sick and die, well, doesn't affect me. You know, I'm exempt. You know, we can do whatever we want. You know, this is how it goes.
Well, here we are. Running out of time. Oops.
Say it again. Yes, we are running out of time. But I think that we always are subject to the laws of nature, ultimately.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Regardless of what happens, nature tends to balance things out.
Yeah, I think that we're all learning that with climate change.
Oh, yes.
And Sandy.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But I think that the irreverence, I suppose, of the early turn of the century was that we were going to control nature, and the powers that were going to control it all. But can't mess with Mother Nature for so long.
That's right.
Is there a call there? Are there calls or no?
No.
No callers and no real time to take a call just a minute. So we're just about out of time. I'm happy that you all have been listening and joining us today. I just wanted to remind you, next week starts the fun drive, and I don't know that we're going to be here or not. I'm not sure at this point. Probably so. So I invite you to tune in. It will be something, probably with our voices here at Heart of Mind Earth at midnight, from midnight till 1:30 a.m. So tune in for that. You could also connect through email. My email is heartofmindradio@gmail.com. Starting on the 8th of October, I'll be starting a new meditation series at the Studio Maya in Brooklyn. So it's a 3-week program, really just the 8th. It's 2 weeks of healing sessions. And on the last Saturday, and that will be the 29th, it's going to be a dance, a Qigong dance, which is very nice. It's trance dance. It's a little bit shamanic, and we're going to be doing that at Studio Maya in Brooklyn. In January, just to give you a little forecast, I'll be teaching a series in Soaring Crane Qigong at the Open Center. So there's stuff coming up. If you want to stay in touch, please do by email, heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And we'll be back to all of our sharing and readings and such following the fun drive. But we do invite you to support the station, because it's important, I think, to all of us. So I'm going to play a little music, and then we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned for Jim Freund, Hour of the Wolf. He'll be in a few moments or so. But I think I'm going to play a little bit of Jewel, Life Uncommon.
Hey, Mother, it'll be all right. Don't worry, sister, say your prayers and sleep tight. it'll be fine. Lover of mine, it'll be just fine. And lend your voices only to sounds of freedom. No longer lend your strength to that which you wish to be free from. Fill your eyes with love and bravery, and you shall leave life uncommon. I've heard your anguish, I've heard your heart's cry out. We are tired, we are weary, but we aren't worn out. Set down
and lend our Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Ah, before the thon, before we delve into the pitchy world of fundraising, the last show with the guest, Zach Zeiss, has his first novel. And before that, that person's from the audience. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. At one point during Shin Godzilla, also known as Godzilla Resurgence, one of the seemingly many hundreds of main characters we're asked to follow notes that the giant creature rampaging its way across Tokyo in really impressive sequences that mix guys in rubber suits, intricate model work, and practical and CG effects is a perfect organism surpassing man. Now, I haven't been following the Godzilla franchise closely. My knowledge of the films is not encyclopedic by any stretch, but that sounds like something new to the canon, that a giant, lumbering, radiation-spewing lizard is not just a physical threat, but an existential one as well. That doesn't come as a surprise if you know the resume of one of the film's two directors. One of the directors is Shinji Higuchi, whose most recognizable works from an American standpoint are probably the anime series Nadia, Secret of the Blue Water, and the feature-length live-action adaptation of Attack on Titan. But the other director is Hideaki Anno, who's best known, and maybe notorious would be the better word, for the revolutionary Judeo-Christian-themed Mecha vs. Giant Monster anime series Neon Genesis Evangelion. Shin Godzilla isn't quite the same delirious mix of surreal monsters, governmental infighting, psychosexual drama, and warriors with extreme daddy issues, but it does reflect Anno's preference for focusing as much on human turmoil as monster mayhem. Neither the child-friendly camp of many of the early Godzilla films, the very first being a notable exception, nor the more action-oriented take that the American remakes have attempted, Shin Godzilla is actually a portrait of how a bureaucracy might respond to such a crisis, spending most of its screen time in meeting rooms, government offices, and hastily assembled think tanks as various representatives of the government assimilate the scale of the dilemma, weigh options, deal with the international repercussions. Not surprisingly, America casts a long shadow, both welcome and not, and yes, deploy cunningly targeted politics as frequently as they do armed forces. This is probably not going to please those who just want to see tanks, planes, and other assorted heavy armaments go up against the king of monsters, although it should be noted that the classic structure of a Godzilla film allows for long stretches where cities aren't being toppled. And Anno and Higuchi are maybe too avid in their prosaic approach to the genre, slapping identifying subtitles on practically every shot in the film, which I would be more annoyed about if I didn't suspect they had their tongues planted at least partially in their cheeks when they did it. Mostly, though, I found the ground-level take on the genre refreshing. As much as a film dealing with a giant, radioactive lizard can, this does capture what it might feel like to be in the room with people tasked with handling the emergency. And while there are moments when the special effects feel a little static, which may be an artifact of both directors' anime background, when they do get moving, they are pretty astounding. Shin Godzilla takes a well-worn franchise and casts it in a new and quite credible light, and I love that. Speaking of bureaucracies, did you know that if you shrank yourself down and entered the brain of a pig, you'd discover an impressively organized office with little tiny pigs dutifully noting every memory and filing away binders full of them in library shelves? It's true. Or at least that's one of the many revelations of A Town Called Panic Double Fun, a kind of sequel, actually a compilation of a pair of Christmas-themed and back-to-school-themed TV specials to the very strange and very funny Belgian stop-motion animated film of a few years ago, A Town Called Panic. As with the feature, this is set in a universe of cheap but very idiosyncratic plastic toys, where it's not unusual to see a Russian cosmonaut giving geography lessons and a clutch of barnyard animals sharing the Christmas table with a farmer and his wife. These outings are a little less ambitious than the feature, with the high-spirited, childlike, and very self-centered cowboy and Indian conspiring to steal away a Christmas log dessert from the farmer and shrinking themselves down to raid the memory of a pig for the crucial test answer that will win them a trip to the moon. That's just scratching the surface of a film that lays on visual incongruities, slapstick, and chase sequences with wild abandon. Unfortunately, A Town Called Panic Double Fun's one theatrical run was this past weekend, but I am presuming it'll be getting a video release soon, and it is worth catching. In other Godzilla news, if you follow Kaiju, aka giant monster movies, close enough, you probably know that North Korea tried its hand at the genre with Pulgasauri. What you may or may not know was that the director of that film, Shin Sang-ok, was a South Korean director kidnapped by Kim Jong-il along with the director's superstar wife, Choi Eun-hee, in order to get the North Korean film industry onto the international stage. Yeah, turns out there are odder things in the history of film beyond Uwe Boll. The story of the filmmaking couple's snatching, imprisonment, and escape is being told in the new documentary The Lovers and the Despot. Directors Ross Adam and Robert Cannon use a collage of news footage, artfully aged dramatic reenactments, and clips from Shin's own films to recreate events that would be ludicrous. Turns out that with the indulgence of an admiring strongman, Shin was far more successful in captivity than he ever was in the South, if it wasn't all so horrifically true. The Lovers and the Despot shows what happens when your greatest fan also happens to be the psychotic ruler of one of the world's most hellish nations, and it is a fascinating chronicle of one of filmdom's stranger chapters. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote. There is still time. And let's defeat Trump.
Indeed, indeed. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program, Hour of the Wolf, the name Jim Freund, the guest, Zach, I said Zeiss. No. You're not supposed to say it. You're supposed to spell it. It's Z-Y-Z. And exactly. E-Z-A-K.
Exactly it.
Yeah, and I don't have your mic up. Hold on.
Indeed, you did that. There we are.
There you are.
All right. So, Ziggy, 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 Zach, ZYZ.
Yes.
No one can find me.
There we go. And this is your second time on the show. Third time in the studio, I think.
I believe so. Yeah, I think I was here with Margot Atwell when she was just rolling out her book, which is the first book from our publishing house, Gut Punch Press, which is called Derby Life. A crash course in the incredible sport of roller derby.
Yes, it has nothing to do with hats. No. When people talk about Derby life, mm-mm. you know, it's not as opposed to Borsellino life.
It's a good hat, but I don't think you could sustain an entire book about derbies.
Well, who knows? Who knows? Okay. Philip K. Dick had short stories about shoes. So,
All right. That's a good lead on where. What was the short story about
the short
shoes?
Happy life of the brown Oxford?
Huh. I have not read this. I've read a bunch of Dick stuff, but I have never come across this guy that I can recall.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually the title of a collection of stories. There are five books that are the complete stories of Philip K. Dick, and that's volume 5. And it's and they are very complete. They didn't say the good stories. although there are some, each book, it's dreadful because you have to shell out for each and every one. But I'm a completist anyway for certain things. I can't afford the Theodore Sturgeon set because that would come to over $200. But the Philip K. Dick set in trade paper will come to like a mere 70 or so. For you know, non-e-copy. And each of the five books have some really winning stories in them, a number of which people just don't know because they haven't yet. They're like the Dick wrote over 100 stories, and so far there are only about 15 films. They're already remaking.
I would give it time. There's some that just definitely will not make it into a film. Like some of his stuff is too far out. I don't think they'll ever make some of it.
You know, I used to say that. But a book that, a fantasy novel, which is one of my favorite books, and I will mention it because the author just died, Shoeless Joe, by W.P. Kinsella, Bill Kinsella, Canadian writer, and is about a